Welcome to the Congressional Awards Foundation podcast, Elevating DC Youth, a collaboration between the Office of Cable Television, Film, Music, and Entertainment, and the Congressional Award Foundation. This podcast is intended to help guide DC students through the opportunities the Congressional Award Program offers and provide information on how to explore the Congressional Award Program's pathways to career goals.
Hello and welcome to the Congressional Award Podcast led by DMOR Radio Broadcast Program. I'm Jessica from DMOR Radio Broadcast, one of your co-hosts today.
Hi, I'm Naya Sutter, also from DMOR Radio Broadcast Program, and I'll be your other host for the podcast.
DMOR Radio Broadcast Program is a program dedicated to the media arts, public speaking, public relations, and networking.
Now, let's meet our guest, Stanley Pierre Louis, ESA's president and CEO. Stanley has served as ESA's president and CEO since 2019. Stan first joined ESA as its senior vice president and general counsel in 2015, where he led the legal policy and regulatory affairs function for the association. His responsibilities included advocacy on First Amendment technology and intellectual property issues, as well as supervising the Global Content Protection Program. He also oversaw all governance, compliance, and contractual matters and served as the corporate secretary to ESA's board of directors.
Before joining the Entertainment Software Association, Stan served as a senior vice president and associate general counsel for intellectual property at Viacom Incorporated. There, he was responsible for developing strategies to protect digital content, managing major intellectual property litigation, and revamping the cybersecurity governance program. Stan started his career as a judicial law clerk to Judge Sixth Circuit. Then he worked outside counsel to several leading companies before serving as senior vice president for legal affairs for the Recording Industry Association of America. There, he led the legal strategy on several groundbreaking cases, including the entertainment industry's legal actions against MP3.com, Napster, and Aimster, as well as the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case, MGM Studios versus Grokster, which resulted in a unanimous decision in favor of the film and music industry. Today's topic is career growth and sustainability practice with Stanley Pierre Louis. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Mr. Stan, in light of that introduction, could you please explain to us what the purpose of the ESA is and how it takes its course in the entertainment industry?
Well, first, thanks for having me. I love the work that you all do and are doing, and I look forward to seeing how your careers take off, and I'm happy to do whatever role I can in helping advance what you're doing. I'm the president and CEO of the Entertainment Software Association. We are a trade association that represents the U.S. video game industry. That means we spend quite a bit of time with legislators, both here in Washington, D.C. and around the states, explaining what our industry is about and what we're trying to do, and also absorbing what they're doing so we can explain it to our industry and hopefully advance and advocate the interests of our industry. So we spend a lot of time talking about the role we play in creating jobs, the role we play in creating art, because a lot of what you see in video games is artistic contributions from animation to music to storytelling, and then the role we play in technology, because we not only make the games, but we often make the devices that games get played on, like the Xbox, the PlayStation, Nintendo Switch. And so we have this great ability to talk about intellectual property and the arts, as well as the technology sector, and we advocate on both fronts.
That's pretty great. Can you pretty much emphasize or elaborate on what intellectual property is?
Sure, that's a great question. And maybe what I'll do as part of that is also explain some of my background, because it was something I was drawn to without knowing what it was, because it is a big sounding word. I grew up loving the arts. I loved the performing arts. I loved music. I loved games. I loved television. And all of those artistic endeavors are protected in the law by this area of intellectual property law. Intellectual property is almost the most basic way of describing property you can't touch, right? So we all know what real estate is and real estate property. And there's another term in the law you learn called personal property. That's like the stuff you own, like the objects that are movable. But intellectual property is the ownership of work that you create in your head. Right. And so whether it's a song, whether it's a logo to identify a brand, whether it's a patent to create this object that you're using, all that is protected under law called intellectual property I did not know that term growing up, but I did love the arts and I loved things that were inventions. I spent a lot of time with my dad under the hood of a car, fixing things and tinkering. And all of that work involved in some way, shape, or form an idea someone had that we could then exploit either through radio and the arts or through a machine that you get to drive or use in some way.
That's very interesting. From learning from intellectual property and like the copywriting and all the patent, I know it's a very, well, for some, from what I know, it's a very tedious process. You have to be very specific and there's a lot that you have to prove that, you know, you are the person who originally had this idea. And I know there's celebrities who try to, you know, establish their name legally and, you know, have their own patent and everything. And it's hard to do that. So in your experience, how tedious was that process for you?
Well, it, you know, intellectual property is an interesting area of law because on the one hand, a lot of the answers are intuitive. They're things that you might think make sense, but a lot of the rules are very specific. And so if we talk about other areas like free speech, should you be able to say this or that? As a community, we decide how far you can go. And we do that either through legislation or through the courts or through that common social contract we have with our neighbors. Is it like, do I need a contract to know that I shouldn't be playing loud music at 10 o'clock at night? Not really. That's part of the social contract we create. Intellectual property is interesting because there are some norms that we might agree on, but it ends up being a rule. So for example, you mentioned some of the formalities involved in protecting patents and copyrights and trademarks. In order to have a copyright, like we are creating a podcast, and there's an automatic copyright that gets established by you asking me a question that's being recorded. We have a copyright. I don't own it. You own it because this is your show. In order to protect it, you want to register it with the Copyright Office. And that's literally a one sheet of paper front and back where you say, we created this work, we own it, and we'd like to own it for this amount of time. And then the law prescribes that it will be owned for a certain amount of time. And once you do that, it provides you with all these additional protections. But you have to do those things in order. With patents, it's even more complicated than that because the copyright is one front and back. With the inventions that you create, it's more complicated. So it is not impossible to learn these things, but they require some study because these are all negotiated results at the end of the day. But they're all there to protect the things that get created so that you have the right to figure out how it gets exploited once it's been recorded and out in the marketplace.
Thank you.
Okay, my question is, what does your day-to-day look like in this field?
Well, it's kind of interesting because if I would expand that, I would say I have three phases of what my day looks like. One is sort of married without a child, married with a child, and then post-COVID, right? And I think about like, I can talk about the work, but also to the extent that it fits in, how I structure my life around work and home, because those end up being competing interests. I think early in my career, it was very easy just to focus on my career. And so I would describe that as work hard, play hard, where I worked a lot of hours, particularly early in your career where you're trying to establish yourself. And I probably didn't spend a lot of time at home, but when I went on vacation, I went on vacation and I really didn't work. And so I might take two or three vacations, one big and two smaller ones, where I really shut it down. But they were very monastic, right? Like you're in a monastery, like I'm doing this and I'm just doing that. Then you start expanding your life to include others. And all of a sudden, you realize, okay, if I'm just doing this one thing and working all the time, I'm not going to see the family. So I have one son. He's now 17, just graduated from high school. And essentially what I did was I always dropped him off because I knew that my hours on the later end would be complicated. So I got morning time and just structured a later start in the morning. So I typically didn't start work until 10. So I could drop him off, get whatever I needed to get done, and then start the day. And I think as life develops, you figure out, here's how I'm going to make this school play or that activity or this sport, and you work it in. I think a lot of that has been thrown out the window with COVID because everyone has reassessed how they want to spend their time. We now at the office, for example, have remote work 2 days a week. So on Mondays and Fridays, people work from home. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we come into the office. And that on the one hand, speaks to the moment in which we live. On the other hand, it compresses your work week because now you're trying to squeeze in all your meetings into 3 days. I joked with someone that if you want to get on my lunch calendar, we got to go 4 to 6 weeks out at a minimum. And I realized part of that is we squeeze all these meetings into Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And if you're not coming in on Mondays and Fridays, am I going to come all the way downtown for lunch on a Monday or a Friday? And so you kind of restructure. So I think that speaks to like how the average day looks because it's really changed in how we structure it. Mm-hmm. I would say on the day-to-day for me, I probably populate most of my late morning to early afternoons with meetings. And a lot of it is catch-up meetings to make sure I know exactly what's going on in our organization. I get to know what's going on outside. I meet with people. I try to schedule lunches. And then I probably try to schedule the mornings to both spend time doing some exercise, because as you get older, you need to exercise to be able to move. Mm-hmm. Old man disease, and I'll stick with me, so I'm not going to say it to everybody, but like, you know, you move and all of a sudden, like you throw something out of whack just because over time you've done it. So I have to stretch and do all those things every morning. And then mid to late morning, after I've gotten in and done my emails, I start to meet with people. And then early evening going, you know, into dinner, I like to get my own work done. So I spend a lot of time meeting with people because it's a way to keep up with what's happened, but also to make sure that you're networking and making sure that people know that it's important. And then the work itself can range from writing detailed memos to our member companies or to the board, to reviewing something someone else has done. And then as a CEO, there's a certain part of your role that is outreach or spending time with people to demonstrate that it's important. So some of the meetings are not necessarily deeply substantive, but they're important that you're there to demonstrate that it's important for everyone to be there. And sometimes they're with other CEOs and coming together to make sure that our teams, if we have a joint project, are going along this, the right way. So there's like a piece of your role that is very substantive and a piece of it that's performative, because when the CEO arrives, it's important. And so you have to demonstrate that sometimes by showing up.
Right. Thank you so much.
Oh, Mr. Stan, I find it very impressive how healthy your work-life balance is given your occupation and your schedule, because that sounds like a lot. But I would really love to hear more about your legal work on the Napster case. It was 4 years before Naya and I were born, but I learned about it through this documentary about the 90s. And I guess it was a really big thing back in the day. So I would love to hear your perspective.
Yeah, well, before you were born. So it was really interesting. So the Napster case was important for me, not only because it was a big legal case, but because it was in many ways a capstone to something that really interested me. I mentioned before, I was really interested in the arts. And growing up, I wasn't sure whether I was going to go full into the arts or another career. And in the end, I decided that I wanted to pursue the law, but I always had a passion for the arts. And I worked in many areas of law, insurance, all kinds of things. But I was always captivated by the music law cases and the movie cases that were coming around. And I didn't know why, but it was just so fascinating that I would spend time on my own learning it. So even if my workload didn't include a case about the arts, I would always find myself drawn to it and trying to keep up with it. I would even spend my weekends reading through legal books on the area of law and the arts. There's this book of learning. They call them treatises, but they're very deep law books. I would literally just take them home on the weekend and just read. And I found myself drawn to this area. And just to unpack that before I get to the Napster case, there's an area of law people call entertainment law. And I thought that's what I was really interested in. But a lot of people think about entertainment law and it's like being an artist lawyer. And I found that I was less interested in spending time with artists. Not that I didn't love them, but they needed help that was for their contracts, a lot of times for personal matters. I was much more fascinated by the area of law itself. And so to me, there's intellectual property contains both that entertainment aspect and the contract law and these other areas. And I was really fascinated by like, who owns this and how do you protect it? And there came this opportunity when I was at a law firm to go to the Recording Industry Association, and they were a trade association representing the recorded music industry. And literally on my first day of work, they, you know, I learned about this company called Napster. So I started in October 1999. This company had launched in January 99, and it was starting to raise trouble for the industry because it was allowing people to download music illegally. And the companies were concerned because they wanted to embrace technology, but they were also concerned that if you're not paying for music, there's not going to be a sustainable model for music. So literally my first day of work, we were talking about this company called Napster that wouldn't play ball, and what were we going to do? And we had written them letters and they hadn't responded. And that led to a litigation that December, and that carried on for quite some time. And it was really all about how do you protect the rights of not just the music labels, but the artists who write music, because the writers were also part of that case. And one of the things that makes my current role so different than the music industry is a song like Butterfly by Mariah Carey was written decades ago, and it's still popular. Or if you think about every holiday season, there's a Christmas song that Mariah Carey sang that is still the most popular Christmas song in the season. With video games, life is a little different because if you love Madden football, we care most about Madden 2023, 2024. We also care about Madden 2005, but the interest level in Madden 2005 is so different. And so there's something about films and music that are different in how long people think about that work versus a video game that refreshes frequently and people like it. So it's interesting going back and seeing the impact that Napster had on the music industry and how companies had to rethink their distribution model. So now you can buy the album, you can download the album, you can download a song on Apple Music, you can get it on Spotify and stream it. And it provided the companies with a reason to really think about new distribution models. But back in that day, it was critical that we established the rights of the music labels because otherwise their businesses wouldn't be able to exist. And for a long time, they lost significant revenue. But now they're on the comeback in large part because they've been able to license out music to all these different services.
Yeah, so I would like to emphasize again, we mentioned it a little bit when we introduced you, but you were a part of the MGM Studios versus Grokster U.S. Supreme Court case. And I want to congratulate you on that and just say that that is like really impressive, given that people don't really, if they have a case pending, they are either waiting forever or for a long while. And I just have a question about that. Because it's MGM Studios, do you think that that was able to happen in the amount of time it did because it was like more of a distinguished platform and it had a higher demand? Or what do you think?
Well, you know, I will say that case moved through the entire system faster than most cases do. A lot of cases take years before they get to the Supreme Court. And I always tell people when they're thinking about litigation, don't expect the speed with which that happened to occur in every case. And that case involved the film and television industries, as well as music and the music writers. And I think what we were able to impress all along the system, because the way a case really gets to the Supreme Court for the most part is you have a case at the district court level, which is the trial court. Then it appeals to another court called the Court of Appeals. And then the Supreme Court decides whether it wants to hear your case or not. And they can decide that over the course of up to a year, or if it's a real emergency, just a few months. So it's hard to get them to accept cases because they get tens of thousands of cases to hear a year. And they might hear, I'm going to make up the number, but certainly less than 200, maybe less than 100 cases a year. And so it has to be important enough that they feel like it needs an answer. And I think what we were able to do as a team is demonstrate to the court that the issue emerging was life and death for our industry. That if you could put movies, films, and television and songs all over the internet for free, there wouldn't be no business. If we had to wait for years to get the answer, it would be too late. there's a body of law called injunction law, which is like, let's say someone wants to cut a tree, but the people around say, this is an old tree that is historic and provides these benefits. And if you chop down the tree, we're not going to be able to answer the question rightfully later on because the tree's going to be gone. You know, there are certain areas of law where you say, if you wait too long, the business rationale is going to be gone for even having the case. And the court hears those arguments all the time about even whether they hear the case. And I think we made a strong, compelling case that our businesses were on the line, that the people who were behind these services were not only in the U.S., but sometimes overseas, and making it very complicated to find them and to be able to enforce the law. So I think they kind of heard the emergent nature of it and were able to come on board. So we were excited about being able to do it. But it's very, very rare to have it happen as quickly as it did.
Thank you.
Okay, my next question is, what advice would you give a young person that wishes to pursue the same career?
The most important thing that I have found in my career is understanding what my passions are and understanding that any opportunity I have is an opportunity to exploit that passion. So I was interested in the arts, but I also decided I wasn't going to be a performing artist. And I knew that I, over time, didn't want to be an entertainment lawyer in the sense that I was representing artists. It was just a different area of law than I wanted to focus on. But I also found myself working on like an insurance case or something else when I was in a law firm. But what you learn is every job has something you can learn from. So for example, when I had to write a legal memo on an insurance matter or on some other area of law, the discipline required, the research, the proofreading, the argumentation is the same as the area that you're passionate about. And so it's almost better in some ways not to only do the thing that you're passionate about, but to do something you're dispassionate about, because then you can look at it in the cold light and learn about it. So I always tell people, no matter what role you're in, find a way to learn from what you're doing, because entertainment companies also need real estate lawyers and insurance lawyers and HR professionals. They are full-fledged companies. I think the other way is, the other thing I mentioned before, you have to have a passion for learning. I spend a lot of time on my own without, you know, being able to build time, just learning more about this area that I was passionate about. And it was a lot of time, and it took a lot, because when you're a young lawyer, particularly at a law firm, they have high expectations of how much you're working on their matters. So you have to figure mm-hmm. out how you're using your personal time. And I used some of that to learn this other area of law. And then the third is I found ways to volunteer in the areas that I was passionate about, sometimes with the blessing of the law firm. So, for example, there's an area called the Washington Area Lawyers for the Arts. And they provide pro bono, meaning free legal services to artists who have a need but can't afford the service. And they are a public service in essence. And so it's a charitable function where you can donate your time and help someone in their work. And that got me opportunities to be exposed to the local art community here in D.C. And when I moved to New York, I could continue to do the same thing with art scenes in New York. So I think you're always trying to strive to do that. And then you have to be willing to take the risks that always have a lot of countervailing balances. So sometimes you're making a job change and you're taking less money. And most people will say, I would never take less money, because part of my progress is a bigger title, a bigger office, and more money. But in almost every step where I took a step back in title or money, I was able to grow in the role that I wanted so that it became more advantageous for the next one. I did not join ESA as its CEO. I joined as its general counsel, which means the head lawyer. And most of what I did in my career was trying to excel as a lawyer. But when the opportunity came about to become the CEO, my colleagues, the board, and others really recommended that I go for this role. And it's been really rewarding, very different than I would have thought when I moved into the role as general counsel. So I think you kind of stay true to where your passion is, find opportunities no matter where you are, continue to learn, have a growth mindset, and then volunteer to expand your exposure and your ability.
Awesome. Thank you so much. The next question is, what motivates you to keep going every day?
I live a mission-based life that's personal and work, and I find a lot of value in identifying a mission. So from the work perspective, we represent the U.S. video game industry, And we've had a number of challenges, the biggest one being perception. How do people perceive games and what do they think about? And one of my goals is to make people think differently about games. We've been helped in many ways by people playing more. We do a survey every year where we see who's playing games. And every year you see not only more people playing, we have over 60% of Americans who play video games every week, but you also see that the age of the average player is growing. So in 1999, the average age was 29 years old. Today it's 36. And if you look at studies even done by the AARP, which studies people 50 years of age and older, they have found a huge growth and spike in people 50 years old and older who play games. I when someone's on a plane and they open up a book, they look really smart. So when you're on a plane and you bring out your Nintendo Switch, I want people to feel like they're really smart. So each day we think about how do we get people doing that? And over COVID, a lot of people started playing more or seeing how kids play and realized, oh, it's a digital playground, right? It's not a hindrance. It's actually enhancing things because they're communicating with friends and family and they're playing. So I think about how we do that. And I make sure that everyone around me, my senior leadership team and the whole team, thinks about how do we advance our cause every day to help people think about that. So that's on the professional level. On the personal level, I will set personal goals so that I will keep track. I find that if I say I'm going to run more, I run a little bit more. But if I sign up for a 10K, which is 6.2 miles, then you'll train. And then when you're feeling weak one night, when I have a piece of apple pie, you go, I got a race in 2 months. That pie is not going to help me. So I usually find some artificial goal that helps me stay focused. And then like the night of that goal, I'm on my apple pie.
Thank you.
Mr. Sent, I see that you have earned your Juris Doctorate degree from University of Chicago Law School. And as I enter as a freshman political science major this fall, I also aspire to matriculate into getting the same degree. But from the outside looking in, for now, I observe society being more familiar with the criminal and the civic legal pursuits. So how does the entertainment and music industry distinguish itself from a legal standpoint?
Sure. Well, there are many bodies of law within both the criminal and the civil aspect of it. And it is interesting, when you enter college, you need to select a major. But when you enter law school, typically you're finding your own path. Typically, there's no major unless you're doing an advanced degree like in tax or international law. But for the most part, you're taking courses that interest you and that start to focus you on different areas. Interestingly, I majored in history. I thought I was going to go into international relations. And when I went to law school, I found that I was drawn to courses about intellectual property, about copyright, about trademark, patents. I was also interested in legal history, so I did some of that. And in a weird way, my career has ended up doing those two passions. So I am in the arts world in the sense that, I was practicing law and now I'm a CEO of an organization that looks at the importance of the art as it's reflected through the legal lens. And some of the work, not a lot, but some of it has an international component because our companies are global. So what we do here in the US can impact what they do abroad. So I actually spend time talking to my counterparts in other countries and understanding culturally how we're different, legally how we're different. So I think if I'm giving general advice, it's follow areas you're passionate about and see how you can bring them together, but have a goal in mind because you do need to get a job after it's all said and done. And so you need to have something marketable. And for you specifically, since I know journalism is important and those areas, look to areas about freedom of expression and about government relations, because those will all inform how you look at the prism of the questions you ask. But also if you're representing someone, what are the arguments for and against what they're doing? So I think there's a lot of opportunities for lots of careers coming out of law school.
One of my passions legally is malpractice law, but I was just thinking, as you said, about, applying my journalism and the communications with it, because media is still one of my passions. I've been doing it for the 4 years with Deanwood. But I'm very curious, as a young person, have you represented any young game developers, or just like who's the youngest person that you have dealt with as a client?
So when I was at my first law firm job here in Washington, D.C., I was very interested in seeing if I could do something in the arts. And our law firm had started doing work with the Washington Area Lawyers for the Arts, WALA, which provides free legal services. So I had both my oldest and my youngest client through that experience. My oldest was a visual artist. She was a painter. And her husband had died, but owned a number of works. He was a journalist, wrote on the Vietnam War, and actually died as part of his reporting. And many of his works were protected by copyright, but were expiring. So I was helping her extend the copyright in those works. I think she was in her 70s, almost in her 80s. And so it was interesting because we talked a lot about her artwork, but we also looked at these works of journalism that needed a copyright extension. My youngest client was actually a playwright in D.C., and he had won the Helen Hayes Award and some other awards here in D.C., and he was looking for help in his contracts for a play he was writing for the Arena Stage. So I got to work with him and really learn about some of the contracts and local law and how to represent local artists. So, you know, like I said before, I was much more interested in the performing arts and in music, but I had the opportunity to work in journalism, visual arts, and someone who was working on a play all in my first 2 or 3 years of practice.
Thank you.
Thank you for being a guest on our show today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I wish you and the entire program the best of luck because, you know, by the questions you're asking, it's clear that you are two very motivated future leaders, but also it's clear that the program is doing a lot to really bring out the best in what DC has to offer. So thank you for inviting me to this, but also thank you for putting so much work into the questions, and I look forward to seeing how your careers unfold.
Thank you, Mr. Stan, and thanks to everyone for listening to the Congressional War Podcast led by Deanwood Radio Broadcast Program. I'm Jessica Smith.
And I'm Nia Tucker. Have a great day.
You've been listening to the Congressional Awards Foundation Podcast, Elevating DC Youth. The Congressional Awards Foundation Podcast, Elevating DC Youth, is a collaboration between the Office of Cable Television, Film, Music, and Entertainment and the Congressional Award Foundation. For more information about the Congressional Award Foundation, visit congressionalaward.org.